Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Pete State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now the GWH Radio Network presents Pete State Pandemonium.
Good evening. Welcome to Pete State Pandemonium. This is your host, Michael Morris, along with, as always, my two wonderful co-hosts, the two pandemonium in the Pete State, Mr. Gary Oates and Mr. Bobby Simmons. How are you guys doing this evening?
Doing fine, guys.
Doing great.
I saw something. I immediately thought of Jerry. I can't remember where I saw it, whether it was on Facebook or Yahoo News or something. It was from down around Miami. There was a 15-foot, it wasn't a boa constrictor, it was a 15-foot copperhead. I thought, well, we should have called Jerry. He'd have gone right down there and snatched that thing.
I've never heard of a copperhead.
I was going to say, I've never heard of a rattlesnake getting that big, but they showed a picture of it.
You say rattlesnake or copperhead?
Well, it was a copperhead, didn't you say?
That was a copperhead, I think is what it said.
Yeah, that's not a rattlesnake.
I didn't know copperheads got that long.
I didn't either.
Or maybe it was a rattlesnake. It was a snake that normally doesn't get that big. And it was the size of a boa constrictor.
But it had to have been a rattlesnake.
Ooh.
We have shotguns for that.
You got that right, brother.
They're cocked and locked and ready to go.
Ooh.
Before we get too far into the show, no bad news this week. Not for the wrestling business. The music business lost a giant yesterday. If you're a fan of country music or bluegrass or guitar players and banjo players, Earl Scruggs died yesterday.
I heard that.
A lot of people think of the Beverly Hillbillies thing when they think of a flat and Scruggs, but I always think of Bonnie and Clyde and a Foggy Mountain Breakdown.
Uh-huh.
I've loved that song ever since the first time I heard it. But the only other news, we have somebody celebrating a birthday today, a fellow Pensacola native, Michael Hayes. Today is his 53rd birthday. We have a lot in common. Both from Pensacola. We're both 53 years old. Both got in the wrestling business, and now we both work for circuses. I work for the Cole brothers, and he works for Vince. And we both grew up fans of Gulf Coast wrestling. Anything else going on your guys' way?
I saw on Facebook today where Kamala had lost a foot.
Yeah, he lost one last year.
Yeah, and he may have to have another one taken off.
Yeah, have to lose the other one.
Due to diabetes.
Yeah, you know, that happened to Peacetack Calhoun and Sonny Fargo. Both of them lost legs. Their legs due to diabetes. Wishes go out to James Harris, Kamala. He was still fairly active, you know, as far as doing, you know, I don't think he wasn't working anymore, but he was doing appearances. I don't know, I'm sure this will affect him somehow, but, you know.
Does somebody have a radio on or something? I hear some feedback.
That's not, I don't know.
My wife has the TV on watching American Idol. It may be me. No, turn it down a little bit. Let's see if this would be.
Tell your wife to go to her room. Don't tell her I said it. Tell her Jerry said it.
Tell her I said it. Okay, is that better?
I just said I heard it. I didn't say where I heard it.
Oh, yeah.
You're putting that off on me, sir.
Have either one of you gentlemen ever been to Canada?
I have.
Have you? What part of Canada have you been to?
Who, me? I've been to Niagara Falls and just south of Toronto, just up there looking around.
Well, I've never been to Canada, but if I were ever going to be there, today would have been a good day. I saw on Yahoo News that somewhere up north of Ontario, a Brinks truck turned over and dumped out close to several million dollars worth of Canadian coins. They said it was knee deep.
Oh, geez.
I'd have been up there with a shovel and as many canvas bags as I could.
I'll tell you what, that's a pretty place up there, and clean, and it's very pretty.
Yeah, I've heard Toronto was real nice. My wife made several business trips up that way, and she always came back talking about how beautiful Toronto was. Got within 200 miles of the Canadian border last season. I'll get any closer this go around, but I would imagine that's probably going to be as close as I get.
How far up north do y'all go, Mike?
We go as far as into Massachusetts. I don't think we go any further north than that. I'm not sure. Right now, I'm about an hour southeast of Raleigh. Raleigh's the biggest city of any size close to where I am.
How close are you to Mount Airy?
3 hours. I looked it up. First thing I did when I got here, I was going to look it up. I thought, well, that'd be a good thing to do on a Sunday afternoon, but I don't know if I want to ride 3 hours over there and come back.
Well, trust me, I would.
I'm still debating. Go there and tell him Gilbert said hey.
Yep, he ain't lying.
And speaking of millions of dollars, do you, either one of you guys remember a guy by the name of Jesus Lopez? He worked in the early 70s in the late 60s and early 70s as Pat Valentino, and then around 73 or so he went native and became Chief Thunderclown. I know he worked.
Pat Valentino was here in Georgia.
Yeah. Yeah, he was there in Georgia. He was in Florida. He came to the Gulf Coast, and he came back as Thundercloud and worked all over as Thundercloud.
Was Thundercloud the one that had the son with him, Chewy?
Yeah, Chewy.
He worked for Bill Golden, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, he sure did. I think that's where he first started as Thundercloud, was with Golden. But anyway, sitting around last night on Google News just looking for you know, whatever happened to people that I didn't know whatever became of them. And I came across a news article from 2005 from Dallas, Texas, where he had been arrested the year before and pled guilty to cocaine possession and distribution. When they raided his house, they found close to $1 million in cash, cardboard boxes full of cocaine, and several automatic weapons and stuff. So he ended up pleading guilty and was sentenced to 22 years, and that was in 2004. So I have no, he was 71 then. I have no clue if he's still alive, died in prison, got out of prison, or what the deal is, but that's just amazing.
Well, Thundercloud had it going on, didn't he?
I heard that.
And he should change his name from Thundercloud to Snowcloud.
Yeah. Now, Chewy was his what, son?
Was his son.
Yeah. He had two. He started with Chewy, and then Chewy started wrestling, and then he had another son named Chato.
I didn't know
him. Younger, yeah. So, I found that weird because I never knew what happened to it. He worked, I think the last territory he worked was in the early 80s down in Puerto Rico for Cologne. But,
so he got popped in Texas, you said?
In Dallas, Texas, yeah. In the Dallas newspaper report that I would read. And the report I was reading was a year later, he had sent, was repealing, because the government seized all of his property, including his money, and he was trying to get that repealed and at least get his money back.
That money's been, already been spent. I got news for Thundercloud.
Yeah. I was going to say, what good's it going to do him in jail?
If they seized all of mine, I'd have to give them an IOU.
Yeah, you can be. First thing they'd holler, you got to be kidding me. No, it ain't no joke.
Three or four years ago, I went to the bank, back when we were still getting checks, and you had to go to the bank. I come back to work one day, and my boss was standing there, and I said, you might ought to go up to the bank. I said, that lady up there, I left that teller in tears. And he said, oh, my God. He said, what did you say to her? I said, I didn't say anything to her. I said, she looked at my paycheck, busted out crying, wanted to know how I was able to survive on such a mere pittance. Oh.
It's amazing.
Now that we have direct deposit, it don't even have to slow down. It just kind of goes right through.
It don't even slow down, does it?
No, sir. It just comes in one door and out the other.
Got wings on it.
Oh.
Oh, man. Well, that's all the wrestling-related news that I know of that I've discovered since I've been in North Carolina.
Mike, wow. You think y'all going to get off to a good start with gas prices going up and everything?
Yeah, I think so. We had the shows in DeLand, which is, of course, our home base. We had good shows there over the weekend. We had really good shows again this week in Brunswick, too, from what I understand. I'm not quite sure where they are right now. I think the first place they're hitting in North Carolina is Jacksonville, which is where Bill Dundee is. He had the clown yesterday or today, or both days, so that means that he'll have them next week. And then they go to a couple other places, and they go to Wilmington, where Ronnie is, and then they come to me, and I've got them two towns in a row, and then not sure where they go from there. I think that's it. I think they finish up in North Carolina with me, and they're either going to Maryland or Virginia. And I'm not sure where I'm going from there, but hope it's not too far away from Nathan. At least I hope that where I can drive to Nathan on April, because my daughter's graduating from college. So I have to be down there. Yeah. And then I'm going to send her down to you to intern on Tybee Island to be your deputy.
You send her right on down. We'll take good care of her, sir.
Just don't give her a bullet.
Yeah, really.
Oh, man. But anyway, our guest tonight, we're going to do this again. He apologized for the mix-up last time. He was thinking that we did the show on Tuesday instead of Thursday, so he was in his mountain home in West Virginia. And he said the only way he can get a call in there, he has to go upstairs and stand with the window open. So, I talked to him yesterday. So our guest tonight will be Ronnie Garvin, I hope. He is home in Charlotte tonight, so he gave another number to call, so we've got a better shot at getting him. So what I will do is, we'll run a commercial real quick. When we come back, we'll try and get Mr. Garvin on the line and let the fun begin. So we'll be back in just a minute.
Georgia wrestling fans, you're going to want to make your plans to be at Johnny G's the first, third, and fifth Sunday of every month, 2 p.m. bell time, for Rampage Pro Wrestling television taping. And fans, if you're in Middle Georgia, make sure that you watch Rampage Pro Wrestling on Fox 24, Saturday 9 a.m. on the My 41.2, Saturday at 10 p.m. Cox Communications Cable, Thursday 8, Saturday at noon, and of course, Rampage Rewind, the one-half-hour show on Cox Communications throughout the schedule. Fans, be there.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Ray Gunkel or Gordon Soley? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first card you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? What happened in Columbus on my birthday? Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past, or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
If you're hurt, get the money you deserve. If you're in pain, get the money you deserve. At Terry and Peterman, we're personal injury attorneys who take a professional, thorough approach to your accident and injury claims. Don't call some long-distance law firm or satellite office. Don't trust your claim to just anyone. For a free consultation, call the law office of Terry and Peterman today, 229-247-0386, or go online at www.terryandpeterman.com. The law offices of Terry and Peterman, making things right.
This is Miss Rachel from The Empire, formerly known as Platinum Championship Wrestling. Every Friday night, The Empire presents the best in professional wrestling
at the Academy Theater in Avondale State.
We're also at the Masquerade every month or so.
Check us out on Facebook. Just look for Platinum Championship Wrestling.
And you'll get the latest details on all the hottest action from The Empire,
formerly known as Platinum Championship Wrestling.
We get it. That's every Friday night at the Academy Theater and at the Masquerade as well every month. We'll see you there.
I need to Google map and see how far I am from Hendersonville, North Carolina, so I can go pay tribute to Jerry's two favorite workers, the McGuire twins.
Yeah, you be sure and tell them I said hello. I'm sure Ronnie's got the word or two for him.
Yeah, we'll have to ask
him. He probably won't remember.
Can't get on the line with us.
I can't get it out of my mind.
And you were their partner. You didn't have to work with them.
I don't know why they did that to me. I don't know what I did to them.
Oh, man. Keep your fingers crossed.
Hello?
Ronnie.
Yes.
Hey, it's Michael Norris, Jerry Oates, and Bobby Simmons. Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing fine. How about you?
Doing great. We were just talking about, wondered if you remember the six-man tag match where you, Jimmy, and Terry worked against Jerry and the McGuire twins in Columbus.
I remember the McGuire twins, but...
I told you he wouldn't remember that. Hey, Ronnie.
You can't forget that.
You tried to forget about
that. Yeah, I remember the McGuire twins.
They were something.
Yeah, I got a good story on that. Yeah, it was in, what was that place? Bowling Green, Kentucky. Yeah, we almost killed one of them. I mean, we almost hung him. Yeah. Yeah, that was a tag match. Never forget that. He almost hung himself. We tied him up with the rope in the corner in the tag team. And he starts strangling himself because he was so heavy, he was kind of sagging in the corner. And he almost hung himself. The timekeeper jumped up with a knife and cut the rope. Yeah, he was turning blue. He would have snapped his neck with all that weight.
I'm sure you didn't have anything to do with that, did you, Ronnie?
Well, I'm the one that tied him, but you know, we used to do that. We used to do that to everybody, but I didn't realize he couldn't turn around and untie it, you know, being so big. You know, most guys could turn around, you know, and untie themselves. But, you know, well, he took half of the ring. How could he turn around? And you know which, that was the guy, well, I know which one it was. It was Benny. He never talked to me anymore after that. Yeah, I saw his brother in Alabama about the year before he died, and he told me that Benny had forgiven me. That was funny. They were like two big kids, man.
After he got the color back in his face, he forgave you.
Yeah, plus when he was laying down on his back, I jumped with both feet in his stomach. It was like jumping on a trampoline. I think I sunk about a foot and a half in his belly. the good old days. You don't see that anymore in wrestling when guys jump in the wrestlers with both feet, you know, their stomach.
No.
Don't see that anymore.
I think you and Kevin Sullivan were the two that did that the best. My luck, yeah. If I did that to somebody, I'd do it wrong and they throw up and all
that. That's all right. That's more fun. just don't get it on your boots.
What year did you start, Ronnie?
1962.
And you start? Did you wrestle in any around Montreal?
Yeah.
Or did you start
in Boston? That's where I started. Well, okay. Around Montreal. Then I went to Boston. Yeah, there was a couple of small promotion around Montreal, and then there was the big promotion with Eddie Quinn.
Right.
And then there was two or three other promotions around.
When you were there in Boston with Santos, I know that's where you and Terry first hooked up. Ronnie Dupree was there. Wasn't Les Thatcher there around the same time?
No. When I went, Terry didn't go with me. I was by myself. Terry went first. Terry was there first. Well, when I went to Boston, I was Terry was in Alabama. No, Les had gone, was gone already. So was Pat Patterson. They were there a little ahead of me.
Okay.
When I went there, there was Dupre. What was his name?
Well, Ron Dupree Gordon, was there Emil Dupree was there.
No, that was the other Dupree. Emil was from Nova Scotia.
Gotcha.
Yeah, right. That was Golden Boy Dupree.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Now you were there about the time Pfeffer was in there with the sound alikes. Didn't they call you Bummy Rogers there for a while?
No, that wasn't me. He called me Gigi Rogers.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, every 3 or 4 months there was another gimmick that used to pop up with Pfeffer. When I first went to Boston, I wrestled as Golden Boy Richard because Tony Santos liked the name Richard because it was a famous hockey player
right.
in Montreal. Yeah, I was Golden Boy Richard, and I was tag team with Golden Boy Dupree on and off. It was just, you know, it was not a steady thing. It was one night here, one night there, and it was not a steady tag team. Oh, yeah, in Pfeffer, I was in the main event in Akron, Ohio. My name was Gigi Rogers, and I was wrestling a black guy that was named Hobo Brazil. And instead of being 6'6", he was about 5'7". Yeah. Yeah. Those were good old days.
What kind of guy was he, Ronnie?
When I wrestled for him, he was an old man then, you know. He didn't have a whole lot of power then. At one time, they were scared of him.
Yeah, they were.
He'd come into these towns with all these names, you know. And it would hurt the business because people didn't see what they pay to see. Bummy Rogers, and he had a Luquez. And then Smasher Sloan was big in New York, and so Pfeffer came out with a guy, Smasher Blown. Instead of Sloan, he called him Blown. Luquez. Then he had a Bruno Sammartino. Anyway, he changed the letters. And that was Pancho Rosario. He had a big eagle tattooed in his chest. That's the name he would do. Oh, it was a trip.
Smasher Sloan. I hadn't heard that name in years and years and years.
Yeah, he was from Tampa, Florida.
Yeah.
Yeah, big guy, about 300 pounds. And he was over. He was pretty big in New York at the time. and old Pfeffer just came up with that name, just drop of a hat, Smasher Blown, B-L-O-A-N.
Now, where did you and Terry first work together on a regular basis? Was that in North Bay?
North Bay. I went to Nova Scotia that summer in 1965. I went to Nova Scotia, and Terry was in the States somewhere, and Larry Kazabowski was a real good friend with, he was from Renfrew, Ontario. And that's originally where Terry was from.
Right.
He was from Montreal, but his mom and dad lived in Renfrew, and they knew the family and all that. You ever heard of Larry Kazabowski?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's all they cared for. A lot of guys worked through there.
Well, when we went there, Larry couldn't get any talent anymore because Mad Dog Vachon used to wrestle there, and he was gone. So was Funk Sr., Dory Sr. He used to wrestle there, and he was gone. And a lot of big names when we're going up to Northern Ontario, because it was a beautiful place in the summer. You know, it was a summer territory, summer, only summer. Started about May till the end of September. So that's when we first went in there. And then in the wintertime, we started going to the States, Florida, and sometimes the Carolinas, and then we'd get some talent. I went back to North Bay all the way 65, 6, 7, 8, and 9, 5 years. In the summer.
Well, I wanted you to tell the story about the time you had to climb up in the rafters. Was it in Sault Ste. Marie where that happened?
No, that was in Pembroke, Ontario. That's about 135 miles south of North Bay on the way towards Toronto. Yeah, well, we couldn't get any newspapers when print anything on about the wrestling. They wouldn't give us any write-ups or nothing. So I decided, we're going to get some attention. And then we had a guy I wrestled against was the Hangman number one, which was McTavish. He died not long ago.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, Duncan McTavish.
Duncan McTavish, yeah. Well, he wrestled as the Hangman number one. And we had Hangman number one, Hangman number two. Two masked guys, and so I was wrestling with McTavish, and it was we decided to he was going to chase me. Of course, he didn't know what I was going to do. I hadn't told nobody because I didn't want to get caught. And so when he chased me, and I went right straight up the rafters, and then there's a beam that goes right over the ring across the arena. It's about 40 feet up. Well, he got to the top, and he didn't go across the beam. He came back down. Well, I went to the middle of the arena, and I froze right there. And then the fire department came. That was the end of the match. People stayed. They called the police, the fire department. They came down the ladder, and they tried to get me down by telling me they were going to arrest me. I just stayed there. I hung on to the beam. And one of the firemen came up, and he said, "No, he's shaking. He's shaking all over the place. He's froze up there. He won't move." So they put another ladder in with another guy. They came down and grabbed me slowly, kept talking to me. And by then, I was scared of that. I said, "Shit, if I don't play this all the way, man, they're going to arrest my ass, put me in jail." Because the chief says, "We're going to arrest you if this is not real." So anyway, they bought it. The next day, in the front page of the paper, wrestler freezes 40 feet above the ring. I still got that newspaper article. Front page of the paper. And Terry was down below hollering, "Don't move, Terry, Ronnie. Don't move. Hang in there. Hang in there." Oh, he was just, he was great at that. The following week, I think we had the record crowd in the building.
Did you go across the rafter again?
No, I stayed away from the rafters after that. Yeah, once was enough.
The other story I want to tell about from those days is a gentleman who was a referee up there at that time became a big name, especially around the Mobile territory, with Bob Kelly.
Yeah, and, Bob Kelly, he came up there in 1965. I think it was the first year Terry and I were there.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, he had a bunch of little kids. He was a good guy. Bob's a good fella. Yeah, he came up there and... You what?
Tell us about the time you took your moose hunting.
Oh, Lord. We both could have got killed. The moose season was open, and it was during the week. It was like a Thursday or something. And I was going moose hunting on a weekend, Saturday. I was going to go moose hunting, and I had a license, but I never brought a high-powered rifle. I just brought a .22 rifle and a shotgun, and we were going partridge, Hungarian partridge hunting. Partridge? You know what I'm talking about? They're like grouse in the south, about the same size. So we're riding the road, and, you know, they come out in the road and they eat gravel. And anyway, we're bird hunting. We come around this curve, and there's this big female moose standing in the middle of the road. And the season is open. I got a license in my pocket, but I don't have any. It's like trying to shoot him with a slingshot. You know, I got a .22 and a 12-gauge with 7.5 pellets, you know. Nothing to kill a moose. And so the female moose took off running, and we went about maybe another 50 yards, and here stood this big bull in the middle of the road. And we're both screaming, "Where's the rifle? Where's the rifle?" So Bob is chasing the moose, and I'm running behind Bob, and I'm saying, you know, don't do that. That moose is going to turn, and because them things are mean. They'll charge you and kill you. And that moose stopped and looked at him, and I swear I thought that was the end of Bob and me. I said, that moose is going to turn on us, but no, it didn't. We're very lucky. He didn't know what a moose was. He never seen one. I mean, he had heard of a moose, but he never seen one that close, about 50 feet away from him. That thing probably weighed 1,200 pounds. I told him after. I said, you know how lucky we are? You know, we could have been history.
Well, Jerry, if you see any moose on Tavi Island, call Ronnie and he'll come up.
Yeah, I'll be sure and call Ronnie.
Now you came down to Mobile from North Bay. You weren't in Mobile as long as Terry was. You were just in and out a couple times.
In Mobile, I don't know where I went. Terry was down there longer than I was. I think I went to Oklahoma, I think. Or Louisiana. Oh, I know what it was. I think I was in Louisiana. The fields own both
right.
territories.
Right.
They own Louisiana and they own... there was a guy that was partners on and off with Terry. It was Chinley. You remember Chinley?
Chinley,
you ever heard the name?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was a guy from Montreal. Yeah, I might have been in Louisiana. I can't remember.
And then from there you spent quite a few years in Florida.
Yeah. Well, I bought a house in Tampa, and I was, that was in 66, I think is when I bought a house in Florida in 67. I spent a summer in North Bay. And that's what it was. I know in 65, after the season closed, the winter of 66, I went to Florida. That's where I met my wife, and that's when I bought a house down there. And then Terry and I went back to North Bay, and my wife came up. And then we kept doing that, 68, the same thing, back to Florida. Wintertime, summertime, back to North Bay. All the way through 69. It was hard to get some guys up in Canada because there was a big difference in the money, too, you know. So it was hard to get talent up there. But we got Mephisto, Frankie Kane to come up there. Remember Don Serrano?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he came up there. Guys, we recruited guys in the state and bring them up there for the summer.
Didn't Vic Rossitani get started up there, too?
Is it what?
He was up there for Vic Rossitani.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He was hangman number two. That's who it was.
I was going to say, he was the other hangman, wasn't he?
Yeah. He was Vic Rossitani. Lord, what a good guy. I like
him. He was a good guy.
Whatever happened to him? Is he still alive?
As far as I know, yeah. The last time I know he was active, he was down in Fuller, down in Mobile, 82, 83. He was called Vic Rain.
Really?
And, he worked a program with Jacques Rougeau Jr.
I'd love to see that guy. Yeah, I haven't seen him probably since 68 or 9, 69, I think.
I saw him in 77. Haven't seen him since. He's a good guy.
Oh, yeah. He's a funny guy, too.
He really was.
Yeah, always laughing. He was a good guy. They were a good team, him and McTavish. Well, I'll tell you, it's funny how many guys you forget, you know, until somebody brings it up, you know.
That's for sure.
Now, how did you guys work Jimmy into the mix?
Well, I married his mom, and then I don't know. I guess Terry broke him into business because I was gone then. That's when I came to the Carolinas. I think I don't know where they went. I didn't keep track of them much.
I think it was
69 after North Bay. That's what it was. After Nord Bay, him and Terry took him somewhere. They teamed up or something. Or he managed. I don't know what it was. They went somewhere and he was his manager.
Yeah, they
were in Mobile. Because in 69, I went back to Florida. Huh?
Terry and Jimmy were in Mobile in 71.
Okay, well, that's where they went then. Because 69, well, maybe in 69, that would have been October, November 69. Oh, I headed for Florida, and I don't know where they went. It might have been to Mobile. I can't remember.
They were in Mobile for a while, then they went to Oklahoma, and then that's where they hooked up with Duke Myers. And then I think they went to Tennessee from there with Duke Myers.
Oh, that's when they called me. I came into Tennessee.
Yeah.
Teamed up with them. That was, what's his name that called me? It was... the booker there, Jerry Jarrett.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then teamed up with Terry had the pink mat and all that.
And from there, you guys went into Georgia.
Yeah, because Jerry Jarrett went down there to do the booking. That's the only reason I went. I didn't want to work for Goulas. Jerry Jarrett says, I'll take care of it. You don't have to bother with him. Yeah, the first day I went into, I never had wrestled for Nick Goulas because I heard so many bad things about Nick Goulas. I didn't want to. And he said, I don't believe everything you hear. So Jared told me, he says, I'll take care of it. So anyway, I go to Nashville. Well, Terry was already there with Duke Myers and Jimmy. And they were doing good business in Memphis. And Memphis was a town that was the money town. They were doing some big business there. So at first I'm going to be in the other towns, you know. I'm going to take their a few weeks before they can ease Duke Myers out, and you know I'll come in as a tag team. Well, I walk into the office in Nashville and. And Christine Jarrett was at the desk, and I walked in the office to get my booking for the week. She says, you're in Birmingham tonight, which was on a Monday, and Monday night was also Memphis. And I was partners with Don Duffy, and she had a bag. She says, here. She says, Nick says, you got to wear this. So I open up the bag and it's a medic's outfit, mask and the whole white outfit. I put it back in the bag and I said, ma'am, you tell Nick Gulas he can wear this damn piece of shit because I'm out of here. And I turn around and walk right out of that office. I was leaving. I was going back somewhere else. I was leaving. And I was almost at my car where a guy working in the office, Dusek, Danny Dusek, come running out.
Yep.
No, 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 you don't have to wear that. He says, just go to Birmingham, go to Birmingham. I came back and I told him, I said, you got too much bullshit going on for me. I said, I'm going to go, but I says, I'm not wearing any of your outfits. I says, the next time I'll be gone. I'll tell you what, after that I never had a bit of problem. I mean, it was like a cartoon place, you know. One day you're a masked guy, the next day you're a Mickey Mouse, and the day after, who knows, you know. Shit. It was like, it was about as good as, his book is about as good as Jack Pfeffer. The only difference is I had to learn a lot since the days of Jack Pfeffer. I had wise up a lot. That was one thing about the business. They give you a hell of an education.
Yeah.
You know, that was better than 10 degrees in college.
Ronnie, when did you start flying?
1972 or 3. That's when I was in Nashville. That was 72, wasn't it? Or 73. Yeah, I went to Gallatin, Tennessee. That's where I started. There was a flight school there. That's where I started going to flight school. I bought me a plane when I left there. I went to Atlanta and I finished, got my license, and bought an airplane.
Now, you guys were down in Atlanta during the war, 73, 74.
Yeah.
Time frame.
Yeah, I never paid much attention to it. Yeah, that's what, yeah, when Barnett was doing great business, so I never paid attention to what the others were doing. You talk about Hank Gunkel and all that? Yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah.
That's the fun thing about this show. I've got one from each side of that war as my co-host. Jerry worked for the Georgia NWA office. Bobby, of course, worked for Grand Gunkel. But I think it was a good time for the fans, especially the first year and a half, because, you know, all the guys that were, you know, already headliners in Georgia that went with Gunkel, and, of course, to battle it, they brought in all the guys from all the other territories into the Atlanta office. It was a good time to be a fan. And then both offices did well there for about a year.
Yeah, I imagine. Yeah. Yeah, I just never paid much attention to what they were doing. But I know they were in business quite a while. Yeah, there were a lot of talents down there. Shit, they were fighting hard. Whoever's going to survive it. I knew I was on the winning side.
When I walked out of Ann's office on Saturday, when we run out of business, and I walked in, I was the only one that had a job. I walked into Barnett's office on Monday. Out of all the guys that was there, I was the only one that got a job with Barnett.
Uh-huh.
And I walked in, and the first place they sent me on that Monday night was Waycross.
Yeah.
And the very first match I
refereed. 240 miles down.
Oh, yeah. Very first match I refereed working for them, and I know this is right in your book of memories. It was a single match. It was Terry against somebody, and I don't remember who, but you and Jimmy came to the ring with him, with Terry. And I never met any of y'all. And, of course, I'd done been warned, you know, be careful, he'll get in your head. So as I go out and I go to check, you know, like we used to when we actually refereed, we check the guys. First thing out of Terry's mouth is, I bet you'd never watch me, but I watched you every week. I thought, here we go.
Oh, he used to shift. I remember, what was his name? Shit. He was one of the free birds.
Oh, Buddy Roberts.
Oh, Lord of mercy, man. We was in North Bay, and we were going to Montreal. Bob Lodgman. You remember Bob Legs Lodgman? You heard of him?
Yeah, Lodgman, yeah.
Yeah, he was... He was doing the booking, and we were coming in. so they, what's his name again?
Buddy Roberts.
Buddy Roberts, yeah, he was, man, he was just a kid. I think he was about 19 or 20 years old, and he was green, man, and he was just shy. Well, I saw him about 10 years later. He was totally a different person. So anyway, they told him, they said, Terry hypnotizes people. And they really worked on him for about 2 weeks. So we come in the dressing room, and so Terry sat right across from him. And they told him he had a ring, not to look at his ring, because he hypnotized him. And that buddy kept his eyes to the floor. He wouldn't even look. That was the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life. He kept turning his head every time Terry would put his hand in front of his face with that ring, you know, like touching his nose, you know, or grabbing his chin, you know. And he had that ring, you know, like Buddy would turn his head. This went on for like 2 weeks, man. Every night he'd sit right in front of him in the dressing room, and he'd have that ring. Of course, you know, Bob Lodgman and all the other old-timers, man, they kept pumping him, you know, don't look at that ring, man. Don't look at that ring, man. Go tell him what he'll do. And then I went for years, never saw Buddy Roberts. Then I ran into him, and he was about one of the wildest stuff in the business.
And then from George, I guess, when after you guys put up, and when you went into Knoxville for Fuller, you were there for quite a while, weren't you?
Yeah, well, that was kind of by accident. I went there. I have been there before. Well, I had wrestled with Ron Fuller when Buddy ended back in Florida, when Buddy was, I think Buddy promoted or owned or whatever, West Palm Beach.
Right.
And Ron was just breaking into business. And we were wrestling in the main event and selling out the place. And Buddy, oh, we beat the shit out of him. Buddy used to come in the dressing room and he says, I want you to beat the dog shit out of him. I'm serious. I mean, we'd go out there and just, and, you know, cause back then, you know, I mean, Buddy Fuller, they were tough guys, man. They busted each other the hard way and shit like that. And they liked that. That's how they drew money, you know. And I guess Ron never forgot that. Yeah. And he wanted me to go to Knoxville, but for some reason I was busy, and I came here. I was here in 1970. I had went in a few times, just in and out for a shot here and there in Knoxville, 75, I think. Because in 75, I wrestled for Watts. 5 months, I think, 5 or 6 months. I had my plane. I was doing double shots for Watts in Oklahoma and Louisiana. Anyway, I had 76. I was here. And then I got screwed in Crockett's office. I mean, they really screwed me, so I quit on them. I went to the office and cussed their ass. And anyway, told them off. And Crockett told me not to burn my bridge. I says, I wasn't burning it. I was blowing the son of a bitch up. And I walked out of there. And I was home about 2 days. I guess the phone rang. I guess they heard I quit. Fuller called. That's how I got to go to, I think it was in September of 76 when I went to Knoxville. And then Crockett even tried to block me from going in there. Called Fuller and told him all kinds of shit on me. Fuller said, don't worry about it, man. I know you better than he knows you. So that's how I got to. Yeah, Knoxville. I was there a long time. That was a good place.
Well, what happened? What led to the deal with, I guess it was you and Bob Roop and Malenko?
I think it turned out it was a mistake, but. You know, this guy's complaining about getting screwed, and I was well taken care of. I kind of regretted it later, you know, what we done, but, you know.
What was still
in Knoxville? Well, there was a lot of recycling tickets and shit, and we watched and saw it, and some of those towns, they, instead of tearing the ticket, they wouldn't tear it up. They'd keep it and resell it. And so we put some people on the doors with the counter, and the count wouldn't come out. So, you know, obviously, he was stealing from the state also from not paying taxes on those tickets, and we weren't getting paid on them, you know. Anyway, I was well taken care of. That's one thing I could say about Fuller. I shouldn't have done it, but it's done, you know. Sometimes you make mistakes. Anyway, we went on our own. We split. And
well, while you were still with Fuller,
both companies went belly up at the end anyway.
We've got a listener that listens to us fairly regularly, a gentleman by the name of Teddy Baker, that when he found out you were going to be on the show, he wanted me to ask you about a couple of angles. Not sure if you remember them. One of them was an angle you did with Paul Morton Jr. about if he lost, he had to wear a mop on his head until
he won a match. Yeah, we had some good show. I mean, we were doing some great business there. I mean, I had to... you remember the Canadian Bumblebee?
Yeah,
heard
that
about
was the
that
other
one?
Angle. That was the other angle.
What was his name? Crusher Blackwell.
Blackwell, yeah.
Oh, we had some good stuff. Yeah, Crusher Blackwell. He was good. Big old guy. But he was, you know, he could do almost anything. He was real good. Anyway, Malenko and Reuben Orton had him, and it was like their slave, man. They had mortgaged his house, and I can't remember all the shit. His soul is sold to the devil. And anyway, they had him, and they were using him, you know, and they were kind of standing behind him, you know, make him do the work, you know. And anyway, I stole them from them. Oh, we was doing patty cake in the ring, and him and I, and Malenko and Reuben Orton were mad, man, and they charged us. Well, we had some great angles. And finally, they were going to get a court order to get him back because he had a contract with them, whatever, and I put him in a box. And I on the box, I put BC. CB. So they kept saying, what does CB stand for? This is, well, CB actually stood for Crusher Blackwell, right? But
right.
I said, no, they in the box is a big old Canadian bumblebee, and they grow big up in Canada. We had Crusher Blackwell dressed as a bumblebee in a suit. I mean, it looked unbelievable. It looked like about a 500-pound bumblebee. Oh, we sold out the Coliseum. And we bring the box to the ring with a big old forklift, and I was sitting on top of it. And they put the box on the apron. And people couldn't wait. When I blow the whistle, the lid of that big box would fly open. Out comes the big bumblebee. People would go nuts, man. I mean, he'd splash Malenko and Roop and Orton. And, well, Blackwell was good.
Yeah, yeah, for a guy his size, especially being short as he was. I said,
for a
guy his size, and being as short as he was, he could throw beautiful drop kicks.
Oh, yeah, he'd drop kick and do all kinds of stuff. He was very agile. Very agile for his weight and all that. Well, we were doing some great business, and I used to call Orton a mop head, you know, because he had the frizzy hair, you know. I used to tell him, you know, you need to comb your hair, man. You know, all kinds of shit. I'd stay on him about his hair. Well, finally, we got a match. I forgot what it was about. And I showed up. I had one of those aviators hat, and I had sewed a mop on top of it. And stipulation was, if I lose, I was going to leave, and if he lost, he was going to wear the mop. And I even went to the matches with a U-Haul trailer. People thought I was leaving. Fans thought, oh, he's leaving. He's losing tonight. Yeah, I went and rented a U-Haul, pull up at the matches. They're going to call the match. Anyway, he lost. He wore the mop for. Oh, yeah, he had to win a match on television. That's what it was. He had to win a match on television to take the mop off. So we'd put him in the ring with the jabronis, you know, like job guys, you know, like guys that, you know, weighed 170 pounds, you know, and Orton would go in the ring and say, ha-ha, the mop's coming off, you know, the mop's coming off. he'd be beating the shit out of the guy and just about to do the finish on him where he put him away. We'd come in the ring and stomp the guy and Horton to get disqualified. And he'd go nuts. Yeah, because if there's interference, you know, the referee has to disqualify him, you know. We did that for a long time. I mean, it went on and on and on, and finally the mop came off.
What was it good then, you were talking about wearing a mask. You were talking about not wanting to wear a mask for Gulas, but what led you to becoming Mr. Knoxville?
Well, I had left. I went into Knoxville, and I forgot I had a deal in Ohio. I went to Ohio, of course. Didn't stay there very long because it never did anything. I left Knoxville on the loser leave town. Might as well take advantage of it, you know. I was in Knoxville for a short period, just a few months, and got this deal in Ohio, and I told Fuller, I said, I'm out of here. I had a loser leave. Well, I lost and I left. Well, about 3 months later, 4 months, it was no more than 4 months, I don't think. That didn't work out in Ohio. I called Fuller back. And Fuller said, hell yeah, man, I want you. Yeah, well, that was no... Back then, you didn't have a hard time to get work. You know what I mean? There was 32 different
right.
promotions. Shit, you can go anywhere you wanted to. And so anyway, I came in. Well, the only way I could come in is with a mask. So I told Fuller, I said, well, shit, I'll come in as Mr. Knoxville. And so, you know, it worked out perfect. And so I'd go to the ring, you know, and Les Thatcher was the announcer. He says, you're Ronnie Garvin. I says, no, I'm. He said, well, you got your initials on your boots, RG. I says, it stands for Rough Grappler. Of course, I wanted everybody to know it was me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But in a court of law, you got to take the mask off to prove for sure that's the person that, you know, I'm technically, you know. So the deal was to try to take the mask off, you know. So I would deny I was Ronnie Garvin. So I'm a rough grappler. We had some good shit.
All those simple
That's the
angles.
Problem today, you know. There's no good ideas. When I see things today, man, I mean, it's so, you know, it's like a lousy movie, you know. The plots and the stories and it's so, I don't know. I think back in them days, man, we used to take pride, I think, in people not being able to call it, you know.
Absolutely.
Throw a twist into it, you know, where they, you know, like the time I pull up with you all, you know. Shit, you could have walked in that building probably and made a lot of money betting on who's good. They would have took, you know, they would have said Ronnie Garvin's losing.
Do you ever watch the matches now, Ronnie?
You what now?
Do you watch the matches?
No, not anymore. Oh, I got to where I lost interest in, you know. They've got some good guys. I remember Randy Orton and you know, but it's just, I don't know. It's too much talking, I think, first of all, you know, instead of the stories being told in the ring with actions and matches. It's a lot of talk. Well, of course, everything changes.
Your career kind of bridged. I mean, you started in the early 60s and went into the late 90s, so you saw it. You were still active when all the changes started coming about. You were in Georgia when Vince bought out the TBS contract and everything. And Jerry's told the story here, the two of you working with the Road Warriors. I'm going to get your take on that.
With who were... You mean me working with the Road Warriors?
Yeah.
Oh, well, it was hard at first. I mean, you know, I remember we had to put ourselves in holes, you know. But they were impressive guys, you know. You can make some money with them. They didn't know how to work, you know. They first came into Atlanta. My God, it was, you know. But, you know, it was, yeah, they were good guys. I liked both of them, you know. Hawk was a super nice guy. I always got along with him, you know, and Animal. But they were green, you know. They came into to Georgia. My God, they were monsters, you know. Impressive guys. And they were a little bit dangerous. You just had to watch yourself, you know. But we did some good business with them.
I think in the dying day, I don't remember if that was all, I guess that was all after the split where Vince pretty much bought out the TBS stuff and only restarted on
yeah,
his own.
Yeah, when that happened, I was up in Canada. I had left that summer, right. 85, right?
Right.
1985. Well, that's the summer I went to Canada. Yeah, I spent May, June, July, August. I came back and I worked for Crockett back. I never thought I'd work for him again because I had blown the bridge. You remember?
Yeah.
In 73, I had blown the bridge. 76, here I'm back. I mean, not 76, 86. 85, 86, 87. Yeah, it's funny how things were. Turns around and... But yeah, when Vince went to Georgia, I was gone. Well, they call it what, Black Saturday or something?
Yes.
Right.
So Ronnie is
Hey. With,
go ahead, Mike.
Jake Rock, was that before or after all that happened? That was after when she came back and worked with Jake Roberts for so long, wasn't it?
That was before.
Okay.
That was before. That was 83 or 84. 84.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There was a... Man, what a guy. We had some great matches, him and I. I mean, all over. We'd go all over Ohio and Michigan. We'd come back, be in the in Georgia. Yeah, what a talent that guy was.
Ronnie, is Abe Jacob still in the Carolinas?
Yeah, he is. I got a Christmas card from him again this year. He plays a lot of golf. I guess he does. I just, for some reason, we don't talk. But I know he's in Charlotte. He's still here. Last time I saw him, I think it was at Penny Banner's funeral. That's where he was. He plays a lot of golf. There's a nice fellow there.
He's a
man.
Sweetheart.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very nice guy. Yeah, it's hard to keep in touch with everybody, you know. Time
it
just
is.
Goes by so fast. And you bring up names, you know, and you say, shit, man, there's so many of them, there's no way you can remember them. That's why I like these reunions, you know. You go there and you see guys you haven't seen for years.
One that I know you probably crossed paths with in the Carolinas, Bill Bowman, said he'd be sure to tell you how long I told him you were going to be on the show tomorrow.
Bill Bowman, yeah, good guy. Yep. Tell him I said hi if you talk to him. Tell him I'll give him my best.
I talk to Bill just about every other day.
There you go. Give him my best.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, I go way back. I remember Bill Bowman, Lord of Mercy, way back in the 60s.
That's right, because I think he was down in Louisiana around the time you got.
Yep. Yeah, I remember he was driving a Corvair. Remember those Corvair cars? The engines was in the back? Yeah,
yep.
He had one.
Yeah. So I guess the pinnacle of your career in September of 87 when you became the NWA World Heavyweight Champion. How did they approach you about that? What did you have that long into your career?
The best day of my career is the day I beat Andre the Giant in Knoxville, Tennessee. That was the best. In a handicap match. Did you know that?
Yeah, and a lot of people know. They think, you know, they believe the hype of that Hogan was the first one to slam him and all that stuff, but you did that.
I beat him in a handicap. It was him and Roy Lee Welsh. Him and Roy Lee Welsh, and it was March the 5th, 1978. I remember that. That's better than any other dates. Yeah. I got part of that tape. I don't have the whole thing. I lost it. Never was sent back to me. I loaned it. But I got some parts of it. And they did a special. So I got like maybe a minute and a half of it. 2 minutes.
Wow.
Something like that. Yeah, I wish I had the whole tape. But, yeah, that was different. He usually wrestled a handicap, two guys against him.
Right.
But it was him and Roy Welsh against me. But, see, I got to tell you, the way we did it is Roy Welsh, I had broke his hand. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And he was, his hand was in a cast. So I told him, I said, I used to call him, I forgot, I had a nickname for him or something. You know, because he was a real baby-faced-looking guy, you know. And so I went on TV and I says, you get anybody, man, that you want as a partner, it doesn't matter who it is. So he answered my challenge, and he says, I got a surprise for you. So supposedly I signed a contract, him and his mystery partners. And right at the end of the program, at the show on TV, Les Thatcher says, we're going to announce who the mystery partner of Roy Lee Welsh is against Ronnie Garvin. Andre the Giant. Boy, I went nuts. Holy shit. Handicap match. Of course, Roy Lee Welsh never wrestled. He stayed on the apron. He had a broken hand. He was in a cast, you know. So I beat Andre the Giant, then I took the cast and broke it against the post. Took his hand and broke it against the post. We had some good stuff. Good. Hey, Knoxville was a good town.
Was it with the Pompos that you did the deal with Knox Baker where you stomped his teeth?
Oh, I had done it earlier with Malenko. Malenko, and we'd done it again in Kentucky with Knox Baker. It's so funny. There's nothing on Malenko. There was, to me, this guy was the one of the best heel in the business. And you never hear anything about him. That's what's so mind-boggling. I've had people ask me about so-and-so. So, yeah, there's a lot of... But to me, Malenko was at the top five. I mean, that guy could... I'll tell you what, he came to Knoxville, and in a matter of 3-4 weeks, I mean, we were drawing big money. And the Mongolian Stomper at... He got over. The Mongolian Stomper got over. But he had to beat about 50 guys, destroy them. You know what I mean? To get heat.
Right.
And Malenko never beat anybody and had more heat coming out of the ring. And, people wanted to kill him. It's just the way he done it, you know. He was such a good close that eye, do his interviews, you know. To me, he was in the ring as a heel. He was better than... A whole lot of guys that, you know, I mean, there was a lot, I'm not knocking it, but a lot of good guys, but I think he was at the top five. If it was my choice, I'd put him in the top five villains.
But you never hear nothing
about him. And I guess because there's no tapes of it, I don't know what it is.
Yeah,
you never hear his name mentioned anywhere. Have you ever had anybody ask about him?
No, not really. Well, they all think of him just as being, you know, his father.
And yeah, I know.
It is. Because I have a little bit of tape on him. I've got a DVD that's got some black and white, probably mid-60s, of he and Eddie Graham. And the two of them
And Malenko was partners in the Carolinas with Orton Sr. They'd have riots. They'd have riots just with wrestling. I mean, unbelievable. Richmond, Virginia, I remember. Oh, jeez. I mean, riots in those buildings. People would... Yeah, him and Sr., Orton Sr. Partners, you know. Tag team partners. Oh, jeez. It's like people say, where'd you get this Garvin stomp? Well, I copied Malenko. You know, Malenko used to do that. Nobody knows that. I did it a little different. You know, he did it in a different way. I did the whole thing going around, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. He is one that's never mentioned when people talk about heels. Of course, when I saw him, he had already made, I saw him starting at the maybe mid-70s in Florida. And
yeah.
He had been a baby face for a couple of years.
Yeah.
But, and then I guess in the Carolinas also, he was, they used him as a manager because I know he was Bill Eadie. When Eadie was a superstar there.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's why. I guess that's why you don't hear much of them, because there's not much of the '60s, late '50s, early '60s. That's too bad, because I'll tell you what, he had some classics.
You're absolutely right. He was.
Yeah.
Great interviews. Again, the interview style. I mean, he every once in a while he'd rant and rave, but for the most part, he was just calm and serious. But to me, the best one.
Oh, yeah. Oh, to me, that was a classic when he closed that eye.
Now, you were both sides, baby face and heel. Which did you
Yeah.
Did you prefer working one style over the other?
No, it didn't matter. It was to me, the business was only business. There was nothing else to it. That was a way of making a living, you know. That's the only way I looked at it, you know. Today it's so different. Hell, I never smarted up my first wife. I married her 15 years. I never talked business to her. And all of a sudden, Jimmy got married, and his wife smartened up my wife. I came home one night, she was pissed off at me. I said, "What's wrong? You never told me." "Never told you what?" "That wrestling was," I said, "listen, remember the conversation we had? I'm okay. Don't worry about me. I got a Band-Aid on my head. I'll survive. I'll be fine." We never discussed, in my house, never discussed business. And that's the way it used to be, you know. Now cousins, uncles, sisters, brothers, the whole family is just, that's a joke.
That's what's in the dressing room nowadays.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and another thing is funny is you do these shoot interviews, and then they all pretend they're smart. Well, they think they are. And then at the end of the conversation, they say, "Well, what's the toughest match you've ever had?" And then I look at them, and I said, "You're kidding me. Well, what was your toughest match?" I said, "It's a work. I never had a tough match. Not one. Out of 10,000 matches."
Come on. I know you had a tough match because you weren't a lot bigger.
I used to stomp his toes, and he'd scream. He painted his toenails, and I used to stomp his toes. And he said, "Ah, yeah, buzzsaw, buzz." He called me the buzzsaw. I like Ox. He's a good fella. Oh, he's a character. I'll tell you, you can hear him. You can hear his voice a mile away when you walk in somewhere. I used to stomp his toes all the time. He said, "It hurts." the business is there's no, everybody knows it. And it's like, you know, watching a movie and you know the outcome, you know. There's no
mystique anymore, Ronnie.
Yeah, that's the word I'm looking for. Exactly.
None.
Exactly. And when I first broke into business, I think you had about probably 30%, 33%, 30% of the people knew they were there just to be entertained. They knew it was bullshit. They knew it was, but they were there because it was entertaining to them. Then you had about another 33%. They weren't sure. You know what I mean? They were going to the matches. They were interested. They were entertained, but they weren't sure. And then you had another about 33% that they were believers. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You
know. Yep. And you had some, man. They swear to God they've seen real matches.
Oh, yeah.
I tell people I saw real matches in the dressing room. I saw some of the best fights in the dressing room. In the ring, I never saw a real one. Oh yeah, in the dressing room, man. I've seen quite a few good ones. You know, because you got all these characters, you know, and you're going to get people that don't get along, you know.
We've talked about this a lot on the show, Ronnie. I tell people, one of the things I'm most proud of is we worked in front of the – we went to – you know, and you did this too. We went to the same cities when you were in the territory. You went to the same places week after week after week after week. And those people sat 6 feet from the ring.
Yep,
And those people, they thought they knew, but they were never 100% sure.
That's
because
right.
Because people would say, I know it's crap, but I was there the night Ronnie Garvin and such really got mad at each other.
They
thought they knew. Me as a referee, my job was to stay out of the way, but the guys were that good. They didn't know. They were that close and couldn't tell.
Oh, yeah, exactly. You're right. You're absolutely right. That's the way, and you hear people say that, and now you don't hear people talk about that.
No.
Well, because the whole family. I mean, it's just, you know, and to me it's embarrassing.
It's embarrassing, and I don't see how they
throw
up.
It's embarrassing. You see these guys going around saying they're wrestlers. They weigh 140 pounds, you know, and some of them are not even athletic. At least if you're athletic, you know, it's not so bad. But, or, you know, you can have a big guy like Jerry Blackwell. I mean, you know, he was a believable guy. He was a big guy. But, you know, you got guys like that in football that put him in the front. You know what I mean?
Yep.
I mean, they might not be able to run a 300-yard race, but hell, they're tough, you know. Somebody looks the part. But, I used to have some discussion with Ole when he used to book the Milky Boys. What was their name? The
Milky Brothers.
Brothers, you know. I liked them. They were nice guys. But, you know, you want credibility. You put them against the Road Warriors. I mean, come on. You know, it's like putting a high school football team against the Green Bay Packers. You know what I mean? It'd be a slaughter.
But I don't see how they draw anything today. I mean, I don't understand it.
Well, I'll tell you how they do it. And Vance is a genius. Vance, is to me, is one of the smartest person that I ever met. And Vance was so ahead of his time. That's why all the other promoters are not around. They all didn't think he was going to make it. They all thought he had the wrong recipe, but he had the right recipe. He saw the culture, how it changed, and he changed the business with the culture. Look at people going, they're going gaga over the, the TV program, they sing in, what do you call it, American Idol.
American Idol, yeah.
Those people wouldn't have made it back in the days of Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra's, and I mean, entertainers back in the 50s and the 60s, compared to today, you know what I'm saying? I mean, that's the way I look at it. People today are impressed over little stuff. And Vance turned the business around, especially the language, when that show that was on TV, Jerry Springer, when that TV turned to garbage, that's when he started just Mr. Ass and Kiss My Ass and all of this stuff, and all the language started changing. And, you know, and Vance follows the trend. What's popular? You know, look at the guys today with all the tattoos. What's the deal with this? Well, that's the way people are today.
Yeah.
Of course, he's not drawing from the old fans. He created new fans. You know, so he's following the trend of the country and the way people, the culture, and that's why he's got all these characters. He's got all that. So in a way, I mean, he's very successful. He's making a fortune. And all the other promoters, they didn't want to change, you know. And I probably wouldn't have myself. You know, we got a tendency, you know, you get in your own ways. And it's like us. When we started in the business, we didn't know what the business was in the 20s and the 30s. You know, when they went in the ring and took a hold and wrestled for 2 hours. Right? I mean, you read about that. They had 2 hour, 3 hour match, 2 hours and a half. You know, and I'm sure it was boring because they just wrestled and took a hole and hang on to it. You know. So the business has changed, and then when Gorgeous George came along, and then the Buddy Rogers, and the business started changing, and they started doing less wrestling and more. They started going to high spots. You know, so over time it just kept changing. And today, well, I don't know what you'd call it. But they still call it wrestling, but I guess part of it is. I call it the trampoline act today because that's what it looks like. You know, the ba-boom, ba-boom, and flip, and the flop, and the somersaults. It's kind of comical.
Yeah, it's definitely a different animal than it was when we were all in the business. Of course, you lasted longer than the rest of us did. In fact, you even worked for Vince there right at the tail end of your career.
Well, I was there 2 years, and when I got there, I was lost. And I told Vince, I said, man, I didn't belong there. You know, with all the gimmicks and all the characters and all the... Because, you know, I was just playing. To me, the action started when the bell rang. You know, I was brought up that way. You know, the hell with the jackets and the smoke and the booms and the bangs and, you know, and all that fancy stuff. And, you know, you walk to the ring, and, man, you get the instructions, the bell ring, and then, man, the shit is on, you know?
Exactly.
To me, that's what it was. If I was going to be in the ring 40 minutes, man, I'm going to give them for their money, you know? And I don't need anything before and after. You know, it's just when the bell rings, you go. And that was the way I was brought up. And when I went up there, and that's why I came up with the idea of the referee, because I wanted to be booked on the pay-per-views. And if you didn't have an angle going and some kind of storyline, some kind of, so that's when me and Valentine, you know. And I like to work with him. He liked me, too. I mean, we got along real good. And I told him, I said, hey, we'll be involved, man, and you make money if you're on a pay-per-view. If you're not on a pay-per-view, you know, you don't make any money. And so that's where I come up with it. And I must say that Vince says, yeah, I like it, you know, and he done it. Of course, he changed a few things, you know, because he always does that. He's going to do it his way. But the basic idea was mine. Because I just needed to be involved. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
Because, you know, you're not on these pay-per-view. I think when I was there, I think he had four pay-per-view a year, four or five. Now they got more, but I think he had four. And that was the key there to make money. And then finally one day, you know, I just had enough, about 2 years, and I had a good time. I did decent. I was happy. But I had enough. I was 45 years old, and I said, shit, man, this is it. You know, 30 years of this, and that was enough. But it was an experience. It was an experience.
You really, there, you're flying.
Oh, I was very fortunate. I came out of there, and, well, I owned 3 airplanes in my career, and I had all kinds of hours, and I got me a flying job. Well, I kind of fell into it. I was flying cargo. I'd done that for almost 13 years. And I had a blast. And I tell people, I said, if I would have started flying when I was 18, 19, or 20, I probably would have never been in the business. Probably never. That's how much I like flying.
Do you still fly?
Actually, I miss flying. I never miss the business. You know, I miss seeing some of the guys. I miss seeing some, pardon me?
You don't fly anymore?
No, it's been, it's been about 6-7 years. Yeah, I quit. I was about 60. Yeah, I'm done. I don't do hardly anything now. Except do a lot of hunting. But flying was, to me, was the... Go ahead.
I was going to say, I know I've heard you tell these stories in Mobile, and the that story I've heard you tell as far as your flying was was it going to going through Cincinnati? You buzzed the boat, and when you flicked on your light, you got a surprise.
Which one was that, man?
I guess
I can't hear you. Talk a little bit louder, but I don't know if it's my phone going.
I guess it was a Coast Guard cutter or something that you bought one
coming
night.
Coming across the lake. Coming across Lake Erie out of Detroit. Yeah, that happened twice. I was about 500 feet over his head, diving at him in the middle of about 12 o'clock at night, and then it says Coast Guard. Well, I turned them lights off and disappeared into the dark night. And then about a month later, I used to buzz people. I loved it. When I was empty, I didn't have any cargo on board. Shit, I was playing on the way home. I chase farmers off their tractor in the fields. Oh, yeah. Yeah. There was a guy one time, he was on his tractor. You could see the smoke, you know, the dust. I thought he was going away from me, but all of a sudden the dust stopped, and you see this little figure jump off his tractor and took off running. I flew over the tractor about 20 feet over. The guy is about 100 yards in the field there next to the fence, scratching his head, watching us go by. He probably wouldn't have told his wife. She says he's losing his mind. There's no airports around here. That's what life is all about. You got to have a good time.
You woke Mr. McMurray up a time or two, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. About midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning. Well, I was so close to the roof of his house that he cut the tree next to the house. That's the truth. He cut that tree. He was afraid I was going to hit it. He says, when you fly over my house, the tree bends in half. Especially in the middle of the night. He thought I was coming through his living room one time. Yeah. He said I was eye level with the house.
He told me, he said his whole house shook.
Oh, yeah. He said, you're so close. One day I did it during the day. He says I could count the rivets under that plane. I'm telling you, them big freighters, they'll rattle your windows. They're loud. My co-pilots, they used to shake their heads. They said, we can't believe you're doing this. They thought I was nuts. Well, I never grew up. What can I tell you?
No
it's
need.
Hard to grow up, you know.
Well, I was fixing to say, all the excitement didn't take place in airplanes either. You've never had a thrill till you're running about 70 miles an hour and a car passes you at 100 miles an hour in the emergency lane on your right.
Oh. Yeah, I was Al Galento in Speedy Atfield in Panama City. And you know how wide the sand is down there in Panama City? And it was a pretty clear night. And I was behind him. I saw him up ahead. I turned my lights off, and I passed him. It was a summer night, and the windows was down. I went by him doing about 75, 80 miles an hour. They never saw me coming. And they jumped, man. I mean, they pulled off the road. I went way up ahead, and I could see them. You know, they were pulled over, pulled over the side of the road. So I went up way ahead, and I hid. And I waited, and I waited. It took about 10 minutes. Here they come. I let them go by, and here I come. I've done it a second time. No headlights or nothing. I come up on them about doing 75 miles an hour. Well, 1 o'clock in the morning back in those days, there was no traffic on those roads. You know. And they pulled over again. They must have been saying, ah, crazy bastard. I can just imagine, you know, Galento. You ever heard of Al Galento?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Not Mario, Al. He was a character. Real good guy. Funny, talk through the nose a little bit. He was the funniest guy. Could make you laugh all day long. So anyway, I'm hiding up ahead. Here they come again the second time. So, man, I'm going to do it again. And, you know, you got to concentrate because it's dark. You know, you got no headlights, you know. You're just looking at their car as a reference. I'm doing about 75 miles an hour, and I'm just fixing to get in the left lane to go around, man, and this car passes me about 90 miles an hour with no lights. I nearly jumped out of my damn seat. And you know who it was that passed me? It was Lee Fields. Lee went by me, and he went by them. They pulled over, and I was pulled over. It scared me so bad, man, when that noise came up on me. You know, you got your arm out the window, and it's... Lee was crazy, too, driving. You talk about driving now.
He was crazy flying, too.
Oh, yeah, I heard some stories about him, too, but then...
I got the rim full on me.
You what?
I said, I don't even think he ever even bothered to get a license. He just...
Yeah, I don't think he did either. I don't think he did. Yeah, well, he was just flying down local, I guess, Alabama and stuff like that. Well, back then, you'd probably get away a whole lot easier than, you know. When I started in the 70s, it was more and more and more radar and stuff like that, you know. It was changing.
Yeah.
I think when he did a lot of that stuff, I think it was in the 60s. Yeah, today it's a little bit harder to get away with stuff. Oh, I remember. I ran into guys. I remember Mr. Wrestling, Tim Woods, coming across the Skyway Bridge in Florida, you know, between St. Petersburg and Tampa.
Yeah.
He's going across the Skyway Bridge. It was about 11 o'clock at night. I came up on him. I eased up. I didn't have no lights. And I pushed him 90 miles an hour. You look at his speedometer. He's doing 90. He talked about that till the day he died. Every time I see him, he would bring it up. Yeah, you know, we spent a lot of hours on the road. We had to break the monotonous, you know.
Yeah, that's what Bill Bowman always said. You guys had to entertain yourselves.
That's what he said. He said, we just wanted to be entertained. We had to make up our own.
Yeah, we spent hours and hours. You know, we came home at 4 in the morning. We slept at noon, 1 o'clock, was ready to go again. I tell people, I went to Oklahoma one time. I don't think I stayed very long, about 8 months, I think. I was back in, I can't remember now. But you were traveling 3,000 miles a week. 3,000 miles a week you were putting on your car.
Yep.
You know, I mean, you just continuously, well, Oklahoma, Leroy McGurk, he was running Oklahoma and some of Missouri, like Joplin and all that. Then we go down to Shreveport, Monroe, Louisiana. You know, and there were some towns in Texas, you know,
Arkansas.
Texarkana, even down in Arkansas, he'd run Fort Smith, Little Rock. I mean, he had a big territory, big area. And he was on the road all the time. Well, even an average place like Florida, you put you probably put about 1,200 to 1,500 miles a week. You know, that's a lot of miles. That's why you had to freight cars every year.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You put 100,000 miles on a car in no time.
Yeah. Was Carolina that bad?
Oh, yeah, it could be. Sometimes you'd have a week that wasn't too bad, but if you happened to hit the week that you went to Norfolk and down to Charleston, or you went up to Charleston, West Virginia, you had Charleston, South Carolina, Charleston, West Virginia, yeah, you could put a good 2,000 miles easy, you know. Oh yeah, some weeks would be easier if you got the closer towns like Columbia and Spartanburg and places like that, and Charlotte and Raleigh. But You know, Norfolk is 330 miles. And if you had to go from there to Charleston, well, round trip, you're talking about probably probably close to 1,000 miles. 900, you know. That's what, in 3 days, 2 days? That's not to... And I used to drive. There were a lot of guys that didn't trust their driving. I'd rather... I said, shit, if I'm going to kill myself in a car, I'd rather do it myself. A lot of guys got wrecks and got killed on the road, too.
Yeah.
A lot of guys.
It's amazing more, isn't it? Many miles as everybody drove back.
Oh,
and
we used to drink beer, too.
Yeah.
We'd get two six-pack of beer and drive 200 miles. You know, like it was nothing. What a world it is today compared to back then. I remember the cops pulling us over and said, put that beer in the trunk. Slow down. Let you go. You know, today they'd have to arrest you. Otherwise they'd lose their job, you know.
Yeah.
You just picture, get pulled over and you got 2 six-pack of beer and they're open in the front seat. You know, cops say, how many beers you had? Well, I think I smoked my fifth. Well, put the rest in the trunk and slow down. Yeah, today you'd be cuffed. You'd be cuffed and put in the back seat real quick. I'd like to go back in them days, too. I think we had a whole lot more fun and we are safer, actually.
It's a different world now, though.
Oh, and I don't like it. I don't care what anybody says. We're losing our freedom and we're getting to be slaves of the government. I'm glad I'm my age.
You're about to move up in the mountains in West Virginia, though. Give it all
up. Well, I got no neighbors. I can do basically what I want. I don't have to get a permit to cut a tree, and I didn't even need a permit to build a house. That's how much population there is where I'm at. Didn't even need a permit. No inspections, no permit. You do what you want. You own the land, you do what you want. That's the way it ought to be, you know.
There's two control now, man.
Well, yeah, that's exactly. That's the reason I'm leaving. You know, it's a big planet, you know. A lot of space here in this world. You know, get away from the population. And I'll tell you, when you live in a place like that, and you got cars, you can go, you know. You can go visit. If you got friends, you can go visit. You can, you know, you don't have to stay there, you know, not coming out. And being like a hermit or something, you know, just, you can go. You can go places. You can go visit. You can go on vacation. But it's nice to be totally by yourself with no neighbors and able to do what you want around your house outside. And, you know, I'm an hour, 10 minutes from a Walmart or Lowe's, and that's good. A decent grocery store takes me about 20, 25 minutes to get to it. You know, if I need a doctor, I'll just die, which I don't care. You got to die sometimes. You know, people are worried. They say, what are you doing in the mountains? You're afraid? You're not afraid? What if you get sick? What if I get sick and die? What the heck? People are next to a hospital sometimes, and they still die, you know? It's funny how people always worry about those things. Yeah, but a lot of people, they say, at your age, you're not worried. The what?
I said, I think statistically, sure, more people die in the hospital than they do.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. You know, and that's why I don't think of those things. I go hunting and I go to Canada and they drop us off. We're 400 miles from civilization on the side of a lake for 10 days. People say, well, what if you have an emergency? Well, if I have an emergency, well, if I can't make it, it's just too bad. I had a bad day. You know, my time was up. You know? But there are people that will not do anything dangerous or any take a chance on anything. I couldn't live like that.
Are you still going to Canada? I know you used to go, once or twice a year?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I haven't been because I've been busy building a house. But, next year I'm going to Caribou Hunt. Yeah, I went to Montana this year, and I couldn't go to Canada. I couldn't do it all. It seems like the older I get, the more I get more plans I have. Yeah, I was invited with, you remember Raymond Rougeau?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, big hunter, moose hunting, caribou hunting. As a matter of fact, he's going to be here tomorrow. He's on his way to Canada. He always stops and visits. But, he invited me to go hunting with him last year, last August, and I couldn't make it. I had too much on my plate. I wind up going to Montana. I had a hunt there in Montana. But next fall, I'm going. Oh, it's a beautiful country. It's too bad that the government is a communist government. But what the heck? You know, it's coming here, too. That's what we got here, too. Yeah. We got socialists. But, you know, I go up there and I get their fish and their wild meat, wild game, and leave it. That's why I left there in 62. I didn't want to be part of that. You know? So now I guess it's following me to the States. But what the heck? I'm going to be in the mountains. I won't even have a TV, I don't think. I'll just have a phone. I read a lot of books. I like reading. Well, I'll just have to let you know where I'm at. You'll have to come visit.
Has anybody approached you about writing a book?
Yeah, I like to write a book, but not so much about the business. I like maybe half and half. You know, I like to write a book about what the business taught me. You know, that's the best education. Yeah. It's better, like I said, than if I would have went to college. For 15 years. You know, I talk to college-educated people, and they're some of the dumbest people you've ever talked to. And they say they got degrees, they got masters, they got this, they got that, and I'm looking at them, and I've said, I'll take you up in the woods, and you wouldn't survive a week. You don't have a bit of common sense about anything. Now, you might know a lot of stuff that I don't, which is not even important to me. You know what I'm saying? It's common sense. They quit making that. People today, I noticed, I mean, especially the younger generation, not all of them. There's some smart people. I'm not saying they're all dumb. But the big majority, it's just dumb. And it's kind of scary. You know, and I don't hate people because they're dumb. It's not their fault, I guess. But wrestling educated me. To me, I saw what you can do with human beings. Just with actions. You follow me? Look what you said earlier. We went to town, to these towns, week after week. And to me, we accomplished more back then than they could ever accomplish today. I'll give you an example. If you go, let's say, Waycross, Georgia, and you worked an angle in Waycross, Georgia. It was a small town, right?
Yep.
Well, the population, I don't even know, but it was a small town. And we used to have decent crowds. You know, we made a decent, made a decent pay. I mean, we made more than the average people. Let's put it that way. I can't remember what I made back in them days. But when I was 20 years old, 19 years old, I was wrestling. I was making about three times what people were making, average people. Paychecks, you know.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a lot of money compared to today, but we made a darn good living. I did. And so you go to Waycross, Georgia, and let's just say you got, I don't know, what would you say, 20,000 people, 15,000, 30,000?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay. And say you draw 500 people. Would you say that was about the crowd, 500, 600, 700?
Oh, yeah. 700? I'm like, yeah, 500, 700.
Okay. Maybe not every week, but I'd say there was probably, pretty close to an average. At times, I remember there was a good house. And, okay, so say you draw 500 people with a population of, say, 30,000, okay? Compare that to drawing 15,000 in New York with, what, 6 million people?
Yep.
You're not doing shit. Am I right?
Yep,
you're correct.
And we didn't have TV either sometimes. We just worked an angle in the town and work a return. Sometimes we got on a microphone, it's your challenge, and blah, 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 blah. And anyway, it was just the word of mouth. And I remember way back in North Bay, there was no TV back then. We got TV later, but everything was done in the house, in the house show. And then all of a sudden, you took the house, like say at 300, and now you're drawing 500 and 600. What an accomplishment.
Yep.
What an accomplishment. These guys are drawing 15,000 people, and they got millions of population. Or, that's what that's much more rewarding. I think you're doing a whole lot more, and I realize what you could do with people's emotions. You can go in a ring and you can have people standing, you can have people sitting, you can have people bored to death, tapping their feet and hollering, boring, and then 10 minutes later you can have them standing up and they're ready to kill you. Or throw something at you. Some of these old ladies lost their soul. They cussed. They never probably cussed at home, never. When they come to the wrestling matches, they call you a dirty son of a bitch and no good bastard and whatever. Yeah,
and hit you with
that.
Their umbrella.
Hit you with the umbrella. Some of them trying to poke you with a knife. Cuss you. Some of these old ladies probably never uttered a cuss word in their life till they went to wrestling. Now, what I see in this? I see exactly the way the world is today. Look at politicians, what they do today. Scared the living hell. Look what the media does. Scared the living hell out of people. Make up shit. You talk about wrestling was a work. What, we entertained people. We didn't hurt them. They came to the matches. They paid $2, $3, $4, whatever the ticket was. We give them a good show, 2 hours, hour, 45 minutes. Entertain them. They went home. They weren't hurt. They got entertained. They release a lot of stress and all that stuff, and they forgot about their world at home. Politicians, when they do that to people, it hurts them every day. It hurts them in their pocket. They convince them about all kinds of crap, lie to them. That's what wrestling taught me, to see the world for what it is, the phoniness. That's kind of book I like to write. All the education they give me, to me, wrestling is the best education a guy can ever get. If you open your eyes and you watch, and there was so many different guys, so many different talent, because there was some guys that had a different way of doing it. Some guys were good with on the mic. They could convince anybody of anything. Malenko was one of them, And
uh-huh.
Yeah, the Hulk. Hulk was a good stick man. He could talk he had a good, even though he couldn't wrestle. People never knew that. He'd tell you himself. Well, he couldn't wrestle himself out of a wet paper bag, But he looked like he could. So it's pretty good when you can convince people. And it's, to me, that was the greatest education. I could have never got an education like that in university, colleges, or anything. Because that's real. That's real life.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that, one of the side effects of the wrestling boom in the 80s was the territories went away, and now there's nowhere for anybody to learn. You get tired of working one place or had a beat with somebody, you packed up and went somewhere else, there was always somewhere for you to go.
That's it. And if today, when they're working with a guy that's don't have any more experience than they do. So you're not learning, and it's not their fault. I remember when I went to Boston and I worked with Bull Curry and Bull Montana and guys like that, and guys have been around for years, and kept you in the ring for 30, 40, 45 minutes. You know, you learned. You have to learn. You know, and another thing, too, that, you know, you have to fight for it to get things. You know, otherwise, they didn't give you nothing. You know, today they go out there and they got to talk for an hour of what they're going to do in the ring. We didn't do that. You just went out there. Sometimes you didn't even see the guy. You know, dressing room was on the other side of the building. That's another thing, too. They kept the guys apart.
Yep.
You know, dressing room was on one side, and then maybe the referee came and told you one thing. This is what they like. Okay, you went out there, and shit. You know, you could wrestle 45 minutes, and these guys can't go 2 minutes. They got to plan this and plan that, and it's just the routine. It's like a trampoline act, you know. I'm going to do 3 somersaults. You're going to do 6, you know, and I'm going to do this. And because, you know, there's nobody to teach them. You know, you're not going to learn more than the guy you're wrestling with today. He's got the same experience you got. It's just like a musician. If you play music with a guy that's equal to you, you're not going to get any better. You play with a great musician, going to rub off on you. You're going to learn a lot.
Well, like another thing, go ahead. Well, I was going to say another thing, that just an observation. If you watch the guys today, it's no offense, Mike, it's like the circus. Once you've seen it, you've seen it.
Oh,
if
yeah.
a guy goes out there, he has the same match every night because it's all he knows.
And another thing, I don't know if you agree with me, but they all try to look alike.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
They all want to look alike. Yeah. They all want the wet look, the wet hair, the grease, the costumes, the styles. I remember being in the dressing room with Hans Schmidt and Bull Curry and Bull Montana and guys like that. And, my God, I mean, they all look different. None of them look the same. Lou Taz would be sitting in the dressing room, or you have a Buddy Rogers. You know, it's another thing. A lot of people say, "Oh, Ric Flair." Well, you know, Ric Flair to me, you know, is an imitation of try to imitate Buddy Rogers.
Yeah.
Ric Flair, to get attention, he has to do something. You know, something. You know, do the hoo and holler, or light a cigar with $100 bill, or put $100 on the table, you know, to get the table in the corner, you know, to get talked about. Buddy Rogers would walk into a room, and he didn't have to do nothing. Just his presence walking into a room. You know what I mean?
We've said that on here many times.
Even the wrestlers, some guys hated him because they were jealous. They were jealous. I was around him a little bit when I first started. And to me, he stood out. He walked into a room, man, and I mean that presence was, you know, and he could work. And, you know, he didn't do the same shit over and over every night like Ric Flair did. You know, I'm not putting him down, but he had the same match for 30 years.
Yep.
The flip upside down in the corner and the this and the that and the that. You know, which, hey, I guess he made money with it, so I don't blame him. But Buddy Rogers was a class by himself.
He was.
Oh, yeah. And like I say, he even had heat with some of the guys because there was a lot of jealousy. You know, a lot of jealousy. He had a good body and he did good interviews, and his work was just, man, he didn't waste anything. Another guy that I really admired was Funk Jr., Dory Jr.
Yeah.
Yep.
And Briscoe, Jack, you know, Terry Funk. But Junior, to me, was a classic as far as wrestling. You know, never threw a punch. He had those forearms and wrestled, man, and just a classic. You know, that was talent. Imagine you work with a guy like that. I mean, you learn, you know. Rubs off on you. Well, I tell people, I says, wrestling to me is like dancing. You could be the greatest dancer in the world. If your partner is a shit, you're not going to have a good dance. You know what I mean? It's the same thing. If you go in a ring and your partner doesn't cooperate, is not good, You're not going to have a good match. I don't care who it is. You know, and it's funny, even sometimes you put two good workers and they didn't have that good of a match because their style clash. You know, they just, I don't know, there's no chemistry there.
It was a big part of it.
Well, yeah.
Right, we're down to about 5 minutes before we go today early, but we want to wish you a happy birthday.
Oh, well, thank you. You remembered.
Oh, yeah.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
I'm not going to make you tell how old you are. You're not as old as Jerry, I know.
Well,
I hear you.
Well, I enjoyed this. I had a good time.
Well, I appreciate you being on with us, and you're welcome back anytime.
All right. Okay. Well, keep in touch. You guys take care.
Good talking to you, Ronnie.
All right.
Thank you, Ronnie.
Good night.
Good night.
What a character. I wondered if you were going to bring up his driving.
No, I couldn't get into that. I'm still shaking when I rode with. Oh, my God. Did you ever experience that?
No, I never rode with him.
Well, I couldn't get into that. You just had to be in the seat to believe it.
I've heard some stories about when they were traveling, about picking up hitchhikers, and there was a lot of things we could have got into, but I didn't know how much he wanted to share. But
just the speed he drove at.
Oh.
I rode with him one time and Harley one time, and I swore, I talked to the man upstairs, if you get me out of this, it'll never happen again.
I understand. That's just like he's talking about, he's building that house in West Virginia. When we went up there and we started doing those tours, I went up there and stayed a week one time, and I told the good Lord, I said, if you'll get me home, I said, I promise, this is your country, I won't come back. Man, I ain't never seen such in my life.
Oh. There's a saying, it ain't for everybody.
Ooh.
Well, guys, you got anything to plug before we close out for the night?
No, I think we touched on just about a little bit of everything.
Well, I get to Saturday. I'm at T-minus 2 weeks to going to lovely Las Vegas for a few days.
Plan to swing through Savannah
to get different homes. Yeah, do that. I'll be
right here. You cannot live until you share a
hotel room with Charlie Smith. Sir, I wouldn't go anywhere if I had to do that.
No, wait a minute now. He's all right. That's my job. That's my job. I'm his babysitter.
You're a better man than I am.
Oh.
There's only one Charlie Smith.
That's only one.
I tell you what, but a better person in the world doesn't exist that I know.
He's a great guy.
Keeping up with you, checking on you and everything. I'm building him up because he's listening. I'm going to send him a bill tomorrow at the mail. I'm going to drop it in the mail.
I know he wrote that promo out for you.
Well, guys, I appreciate it as always. Love doing this. We'll see what kind of trouble
we can get into next week. I'm
sure we will.
Yeah, man, you guys have a good week, and
we'll
miss on you first part of next week, and we'll take it from there.
All right,
guys. Y'all stay out of trouble.
Got to.
We'll try.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night. Oh.
For listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.